This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The MC Tariq Trotter, who's known in music as Black Thought, is considered by many to be one of the best rappers of all time. And you probably know his work with The Roots, the long-running hip-hop collective that's been the house band for Jimmy Fallon for more than a decade.
Please welcome, from the legendary Roots crew, a multiple Grammy Award winner, Tariq Trotter, a.k.a. Black Thought.
Oh, yeah, yes. Team Metaphor in the house. Thank you so much. I love having you on this side, man.
Yeah, man, me too. You know, it's cool. One step closer to behind the desk.
Outside of his long career with The Roots, Trotter has also worked as an actor. Lately, he's been performing comedy, too, and he's just made his theatrical debut in Black No More.
I heard a doctor preaching about a science that could turn black white without the bleaching.
What doctor? What are you thinking? That hooch must have you sinking into some insane...
Trotter wrote most of the music and lyrics, and the book is by John Ridley. The show is based on a satirical novel of the Harlem Renaissance that dates from 1931. Trotter stars as a doctor who invents a treatment to make black people look white.
Can I hear someone say killing? No lives are at risk. Need I remind you how many years for which I've been in practice before this scientific breakthrough? Please allow me to reshape and awake you. Allow me to take and remake you. Go ahead. Thank you. I'll charge a mere half yard for a tone so pure you'll be black no more and back for an encore.
And if not, you'll be in a...
Staff writer Jelani Cobb spoke with Tariq Trotter in the lobby of the theater just before rehearsal.
How do you think of yourself, you know, in the rare event that you might have to go someplace and people don't know who you are? How do you introduce yourself?
I always introduce myself as Tariq. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all. I think it's weird. You know, hi, I'm Black Thought. I think it's, I mean, you know, people make choices and it's cool if you go by your moniker or whatever. But yeah, for me, I've always sort of separated church and state in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Black Thought. I never take a shot. I make the beginning box track a damn.
So how did the name Black Thought, which is I think one of the more indelible in hip hop, how did that name come about?
Originally, I had a bunch of nicknames that have to do with, you know, just my skin tone, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Some would hurt my feelings when I was a young person, some not so much. You know, when I lived in UK for a while, my friends referred to me as a blacker, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When I was a little guy in South Philly sometimes, I ran with some Puerto Rican kids and they would call me Black Boy Roy. But yeah, there was always like, you know, just a blackness associated with how I referred to myself.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up as a visual artist, painting and You know, I went to the high school for creative and performing arts, which is where the roots began. And just as a visual artist there, sometimes, you know, using my palette, trying to come up with different shades or different dark tones of black or something close to blackness, I would have to use almost every color in the palette.
I rip the vocal back, flip, yo, the kid is a bad bro. I could drip and hip and then dip into calypso. Adios, amigo, which means I got stitchio. Makes you wonder about my number, guess my address on my P.O. Here's a hint, I'm from Villa with the dub, but not the Rio.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, sort of, you know, it resonated with me as one of the parallels of my style. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely at the time, too, I was sort of throwing everything against the wall to see what stuck. And I would do, you know, dance hall stuff, and I would sing a little bit. And I would do one song where I sound more like Chuck D or, you know, someone who would be associated with Public Enemy. And then the next song would be like more, you know, Juice Crew. You know what I mean? So I just had all these different, you know, tones of style.
You mentioned that you started out as a visual artist, and you know, you did sculpture, you did painting. And how did rapping come to be the preeminent forum for your art?
For me, I was born in 1973 in October, arguably 2 months after hip hop was born.
Mm.
So we grew up as one. That was sort of all I knew, and everyone that I knew. I come from an era where, you know, we embraced the culture in its entirety. So I, you know, was a rapper, I was a b-boy, I was a graffiti artist, I was, you know, a DJ, I was a human beatbox, I, you know, everything that came with it was a part of my life. But you know, throughout, you know, I was always a visual artist because that's what my, you know, mother had sort of, you know, steered me towards. You know, she sent me to art school, and, you know, whenever she could afford, you know, art classes on a Saturday, or there was an art camp that was associated with the city of Philadelphia that you could do during the summer, you know, so you, just to keep me from sitting idly by 11 or 12 in the afternoon, when some of my other friends would be just waking up and getting outside for the day, I would be coming back from, you know, having, you know, taking art classes.
One of the things I think that stands out about your work and your lyricism in particular is just how many literary references and allusions there are. You know, it's almost like finding your way through a card catalog.
Yeah.
And the names of albums, you have, you know, Things Fall Apart, which is also the title of a novel by Chinua Achebe, and The Tipping Point, which is also a book by, you know, my colleague Malcolm Gladwell. Mm-hmm. On Streams of Thought, Volume 1, you have a song titled Dostoevsky.
Story written without a ghost writer, the author before me. This is crime and punishment. I'm the judge and the jury. Listen, Dostoevsky.
And so I wondered how that got started, and, you know, what role literature has played in influencing your art.
I feel like the arts has always come to me more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once I realized that something that I could say in a song might inspire someone else to, you know, want to do more research, or, you know, want to sort of dig beyond that song to get a better understanding of, you know, what made me make that reference, then it became like a benchmark, you know what I mean? I think Killer Priest from Wu-Tang Clan once said that too much knowledge could break up the rhyme, which is very true. You know, it's easy to come off as preachy or teachy, and, you know, to have the listener begin to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a delicate balance. Yeah.
So your last studio album with The Roots was 2014. Is there anything in the works with you all now?
Yeah, you know, we've been working on a new Roots album since then.
Mm.
And, Yeah, I feel like we could have put out, you know, a few mm-hmm. at this point, just because of the way, you know, we work. We sort of overindulge in the studio and like in the process, and I've come to appreciate just the feeling, the power that lies within having the content sort of done and then doing some more. You know what I mean? So I never want to be, you know, presented with, okay, it's time to do an album, or it's time to work on this thing, and now I have to figure out what I'm going to do. So once I got ahead of the curve a little bit, I've been really conscious to sort of stay there. So I got, you know, like my next 8 albums are in my phone right now. But and then, you know, the Roots album, because we're a collective, once we're all, really once Questlove and I agree that the album is done, then it's done. But you know, it could be done tomorrow if we needed to be.
In 2017, end of 2017, you dropped a 10-minute freestyle on Funk Master Flex's show, and which people thought was of it as a kind of astounding example of freestyle rapping. Can you tell me about how that came about?
It was, I think, on a Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. Whatever day it was, we had recorded two Tonight shows. So I was pretty tired. It was cold. It was the dead of winter. So I hit Flex up and told him I was going to come through.
I'm sorry for your loss. There's somebody dead in the car, and it's probably one of yours. The writing all across the window in the walls. Whether it was true or false, we shouldn't have got involved. Remember, we walked past the teacher, take the chalk and laugh. We wrote punishments. I will not talk in class. Now it's pistols punishing people for talking fast. And all these innocent bystanders is hauling ass. I hate to say I told y'all, but I told y'all things fall apart when it's in a 2 week to hold y'all. I'm just collecting what you owe to my old jaw. You about to get swooped down.
Did reaction surprise you?
I was a little surprised by the reaction, because I didn't do anything differently than I've always done. You know, I didn't say, hey, I'm going to rap for 9 or 10 minutes and I'm going to say all these things. I just went to sort of do what I do. And it took place during a time where what it is that I do and what I grew up doing was far less common, and, you know, just felt more alien and reminded people, oh, shit, like this is, you know, how you really do it. Yeah.
So in terms of performance, is it different? I mean, you have been on a stage for the majority of your life at this point. Is it different performing in a musical context than it is in a theatrical context? You know, what's it like? What has it been like thus far going up on stage and doing the play?
It's very different when I'm rapping at a rap show, or, you know, if I'm at, I don't know, if I'm performing with an orchestra, if I'm performing at, you know, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, it's always about the movement. I'm, you know, speaking a lot more with my hands, with my body. I'm moving around. I'm making eye contact with a lot of lots of you know, the folks in the audience. And here, or at least with Black No More, it's more about a stillness. You know, so as not to distract, not to take away from, you know, what's being said. I've had to learn to just be more still and to engage with the audience in a different way. But, you know, when you get a laugh or a gasp or an applause, it works in the same way that it does, or that it would on stage doing comedy, or on stage, you know, with the Roots.
Because you do comedy also.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, I mean, Broccoli Rob, it's like, it's the only broccoli that's bitter for no reason. It's like, come on, man, way to bring the room down, Rob. I mean, no, like, think about it. All the other broccoli is good, right? Like the little baby broccolini, little organic broccolini. It tastes, it's almost sweet. All the cousins, cauliflower, they're having a moment right now. They're good.
They are having a moment right
even,
now.
Even the OG broccoli with the afro. It's good, but then Rob is just like bitter for no reason. I don't like it. You can tell whenever all the broccoli family gets together, they're like, if Rob calls, I'm not here.
You're up there as a comedian, you're sort of on your own. It's just you and your ideas and a microphone and, you know, no light show and no band. And, you know, so it's something that I began to, you know, just make myself more comfortable with, being vulnerable in that way on stage. You know what I'm saying? I've spent most of my career, you know, wearing sunglasses and with my hat pulled down low and, you know, just with very many layers of almost defense, you know, after having done this for over 30 years, it's like, what else can I do? You know, how can I become better? How can I become a better storyteller, a better performer? And I arrived at just to become more personal, mm-hmm. more personal, more personable. You know, it's been, you know, definitely, a cathartic sort of exercise for me.
You tell me, how did your involvement with Black No More come about?
My involvement with Black No More came about maybe 6 or 7 years ago now, when there was an opportunity was presented to, you know, to me, well, really to the Roots as a collective, to create some music that would, you know, potentially be associated with a theatrical interpretation of the book Black No More. And you know, John Ridley, who I think had been thinking about this project for quite some time, he clicked up with Scott Elliott and decided, you know, that it might be a cool idea to try and, you know, step into the realm of theater. John Ridley is a TV film person, that's his mm-hmm. background. Mm-hmm. And Scott Elliott, you know, had more experience in the realm of theater. And the Roots, you know, we make music. So it was definitely, it made sense as a trifecta. So yeah, it wound up, you know, as one of those projects that just landed in my lap because I was able to sort of carve out enough time to do it.
Ah yes, Harlem, still many a river left to cross. If I offer to build you a bridge to safety, would that be such a loss? If I freed you of those limits, academics knows no gimmicks. The irons and chains you're in, it all could change in a New York minute.
All is just a place, it's the place to be.
You know, over time, my focus became almost rapping as little as possible. Mm. You know, I wanted this to be more above and beyond folks' expectations. You know, oh wow, Black Thought from the Roots, he's done this musical. I'm sure it's going to be, you know, super lyrical, and you know what I mean, everyone's going to be rapping their ass off. But when you come in, and you know, then you realize that you know, I've written love songs and duets and, you know, power ballads and, you know, country western ditties and mm-hmm. You know, stuff that's, you know, more associated with classical musical theater. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a pleasant surprise. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh wow, it speaks to my talents as a force to be reckoned with mm-hmm. in a different way.
It's the range of creative work.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a broader question, which is, you know, that hip hop in particular, but entertainment in general is punishing. It's not known for giving people opportunities for reinvention. You know, longevity is not a given. And so I wonder what it means to you to be connected to an art form from childhood and to now have reached the age that you've reached and to still be thriving, to still be performing, to still be able to break new creative ground in the work that you're doing.
It's a blessing for me. It's something that I definitely don't take, you know, for granted. And I'm just very grateful. Those same limitations, they go beyond hip hop. Those limitations, in that sort of limited expectation of that limited range of expectation is placed on us as a people. You know what I mean? As a culture, as, you know, just a Black man, as a Black person. And when I was a young person, lots of my friends and family didn't make it, you know, to the age of 20. Mm. You know, let alone 30 or 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. It was something that I just couldn't foresee. So, I feel like I'm in an anomaly and almost an exception in many ways that I've made it as far, you know, as I have. But that said, I still feel like there's so very far to go. There's so, you know, there's still many rivers to cross. I've never felt as though, I've arrived, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm. But, you know, that said, I'm still very thankful to be wherever it is that I am.
the rapper Tariq Trotter, also known as Black Thought. He spoke with Jelani Cobb, staff writer at The New Yorker. Black No More is in previews, and it opens this month. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
God bless Harlem.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, you might say with more than 25 Jack Reacher novels out there, plus a couple of Tom Cruise movies, that maybe we don't need a Jack Reacher TV series. But who can ever get enough of Jack Reacher, that former military cop who roams from town to town like some crew-cut samurai, setting things right with his unerring and incredibly violent code of morality? The 8-episode series Reacher just premiered on Amazon.
Well, a smart move would be to shoot me right here, but you haven't done that yet. Maybe you don't want to draw attention firing outside a crowded bar. Or maybe you have orders to take me to your boss so we can find out how much I know. Whatever it is, it means that when I make my move, you're going to hesitate. And you guys know what Cato said about hesitation, right? He who hesitates...
This all-American tough guy is the creation of Englishman Lee Child, who was born James Grant. He graduated law school before beginning a career in television, all before his immensely successful run writing action thrillers. I had a chance to talk with Lee Child back in the summer of 2018. It was just before the Jack Reacher novel Past Tense had come out. Lee Child, is an absolute delight to have you here. You've made so many summers come alive for me reading you. I never read on the beach. I don't know why people do that, but at least I go outside and I read a Lee Child novel. I'm a happy, happy boy.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Thank you.
Well, so I'm full of questions, and naturally I want to ask you about the way this all began. You were working as an executive in 1995, and you got fired and decided, to hell with it, I'm going to work for myself and become a superstar writer of thrillers.
Well, it wasn't quite that linear. I was a television director and very happy where I was. It was in Britain during what, in retrospect, looks like a golden age of drama, is well remembered. I mean, my company did Jewel in the Crown, Brideshead Revisited, Prime Suspect. Just some really terrific shows, but it was also a fabulous news station, documentary station. It was really the height of the height. And then broadcasting in Britain, like I think everywhere in the world, got shook up, particularly by Rupert Murdoch's influence, and the whole thing started to fall apart.
You lost your job because of Rupert Murdoch?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Rupert Murdoch wanted to bring his satellite service to Britain, and in order to do that, he needed to attack and weaken the terrestrial services, the BBC and the independent broadcasters. And it was a pretty transparent deal with the Thatcher government. You know, you let me do this, help me out a little bit, and I will support you in my papers and on the air.
Why did you, and you were named Jim Grant still then,
uh-huh.
Why did you get fired?
Because I was 39 years old, an expensive veteran with a big salary and benefits, a pension, and all that kind of thing. And they discovered that they could get recent graduates to do the work for a quarter of the price.
So now, what made you believe that you could walk out the door, sit down, change your name, and become a great writer of thrillers?
Well, I didn't necessarily believe it. I just thought that at that age, at that stage of your life, this is probably the last chance to try something new, to make a big break. I did not want to leave the world of entertainment. I'm just totally in love with that idea. I mean, you very kindly mentioned you sit outside in a chair and read my book and enjoy it. And I just absolutely love that transaction, that I can do something that somebody else is going to enjoy. And television satisfied that for a long time. But when I left television, I wanted to stay in that world, basically. So the question was, how can I stay? What can I do that will supply me with the same feeling?
So you did a particular thing, not just one, a series of particularities. First of all, you invented Jack Reacher and stuck with him. He's an American. You're not. He's a complete loner. Malcolm Gladwell and others have compared him to a kind of cowboy. It's like the form of a Western, a man who wanders into a town, in his case, hitchhikes in. No change of clothes. His only possession is a toothbrush. He senses trouble and complications begin.
Yeah.
Former military policeman. So how did you invent him? Why is he an American?
Well, it was a whole batch of reasons that happily all pointed in the same direction. First of all, you know, really the hardest thing about being a writer, or I suppose an artist of any kind, is that you have to believe several different things, some of which are contradictory, but you have to believe them all 100%, completely wholeheartedly. And of course, I believe that this is an art, it's a craft, it's a joy, it's creative, all that good stuff. But it's also a job, it's a business. And so I had a vague eye on the business side of it, which was that so many other people, in fact, everybody else that was writing a series was writing essentially a soap opera with a fixed location. It would either be location-based or employment-based or both, and the hero would have probably colleagues and a superior he didn't like and subordinates that were difficult. He would have possibly a partner, an apartment, a favorite bar, a favorite restaurant, neighbors, the whole thing, the classic soap opera, which I'm in no way denigrating. I worked in television. I made my living on soap operas for nearly two decades. They're incredibly powerful and actually quite sophisticated form of narrative. But everybody was doing it. So I thought, well, let's not do that. Let's do the anti-soap opera.
Strip it down.
Yeah, where there's only one character. There's no repertory cast surrounding him. There's one character. There's no location. He can be anywhere. He has no job, so he can do anything. So it was really a study in loneliness, alienation in a way. And that had to be in America because Malcolm Gladwell talks about cowboys. Well, yeah, that's fine, but where did cowboys come from? The cowboy myth is essentially a development of a medieval myth from Europe, the knight errant.
Knight, yeah.
The knight who has somehow transgressed against the court and has been banished, sentenced to wander the land and do good deeds. Same thing in Japan, Japanese culture, the ronin, exactly the same thing, a samurai who's been disowned by his master and sentenced to wander the land doing good deeds. So it's really that tradition, and you can't do that in Britain. Britain is too small. It is too densely populated. There are no empty areas. There's no mystery about it. America has the frontier feel.
Wandering into the Cotswolds wouldn't work in the same way as Nebraska.
It totally wouldn't, because everybody in the Cotswolds knows your business immediately and everybody knows everything. There's no possibility of hidden secrets. It has to be the wide open spaces.
Now, I can't believe you write the way you've described this. You sit down every year at September 1st You don't sit down with an outline. You don't do research, even though some of your novels seem to indicate, a knowledge of opioids or a knowledge of this of place. And then you just start, and off you go. That's a very strange way to write any kind of novel, much less.
It is.
But I would have thought a Jack Reacher novel would be pretty heavily plotted, and you'd have charts on the wall.
Absolutely not. Nothing on the wall. And, it's summertime now, and acutely aware that September the 1st is approaching. And I'm thinking, I have zero idea.
How do you feel about that? Is it impending doom or
pleasure?
Yeah,
half my mind is impending doom. You know, the gas tank is empty. Finally, I've been found out. Finally, it's all going to fall apart. And then I think, well, wait a minute, you felt like that for the last 20 books. And so you've managed them before, you can manage this one. And for me, it's always about the story. And I want the story to be organic, naturally unfolding. And I feel that if I wrote an outline, it would be a rather artificial structure. I'd be forcing the story into an artificial route that it probably didn't want to take. So I just start in the beginning and I hope to get a good first sentence or a good first paragraph, and then I think, well, all right, now what happens? What happens now?
Do you ever go 75 pages in and it's a bust and you have to start again?
Never.
How is that possible?
Well, two reasons. First of all, that would be very inefficient. It would drive me mad to do that. And I can usually tell before about 7 words if I'm heading down a bad track. I can tell pretty early, and so I sometimes delete 7 words, but that hurts quite a lot, I'll tell you. But it's really about one thing leads from another in a very organic way. For instance, the new book, Past Tense, I wrote the first sentence, and the first paragraph anyway, and there were two things in it. One I had mentioned, Maine. Reacher has to start from somewhere. So he's in Maine for the summer. Now he's planning to head south for the winter.
And he gets to New Hampshire.
Right. He only gets as far as New Hampshire, but he's planning to go all the way south to Southern California. Like the birds migrate. And I have a pretty mellifluous sentence there in the beginning about the migration of birds, some typical species. And I just wrote that thinking, okay, this is a good place to start. And then immediately, first of all, the bird watching. Well, years ago in one of the books, it was mentioned that Reacher's father was a bird watcher, because I wanted the contrast between a pretty vicious marine soldier and his hobby, which was bird watching. I found that an interesting contrast. So in the back of my mind, okay, why have I started this with a reference to birds? Maybe this book ought to be about Reacher's father. You know, I start on September 1st because that's the anniversary of when I started the very first book. So it's a sentimental day to start. I start on the 1st of September and work every available day until the book is finished, which is usually around the next March because a lot of other things get in the way.
Oh, you do leave your desk. You'll leave town.
I've got family stuff. They want to do Christmas and all those kind of things.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, they drag you away.
Now, this is one of the most amazing things. At a certain point, I think you were writing Make Me. An English academic named Andy Martin sat there with you in your study and watched you write a novel.
Yeah, he was
30 cups of coffee a day, like Balzac.
Yeah, possibly more. I think my record is mid-30s. Mugs of coffee, not just little cups. You know, let's get serious about this.
That's impressive. You have an impressive stomach.
Yeah, Andy was happened very short notice. He's a rather freewheeling academic from Cambridge University, and literally days before I started that novel, he came up with that idea. And probably if I'd had longer to think about it, I would have said no. But because time was short, it was my 20th book, I just thought, let's do something different. And to a certain extent, I wanted to have it on record, not for me personally necessarily, but for all of us in this genre, because there is a lot of cheap talk about how it's somehow easy to write these books, that there are various terms used, crank them out and so on, which is actually very much the opposite of the truth.
But even the way you describe it, it sounds easy. You sit down on September 1st, you don't write a second or third or 50th draft. No outline. So what is the difficulty? Describe that.
Well, really the difficulty is with a readership the size of a successful genre writer's readership.
And what is this? Kill me. Go ahead and kill me. What is the scale of your readership?
Well, millions of people, you know, globally around the world. A Reacher book sells every 9 seconds. So there's a lot of people reading them. And you cannot look at that as a monolithic mass because with an audience that size, they're very striated. They're very different. At the center, you've got the expert readers who just read all the time, like Malcolm Gladwell. You know, mine is not the only book that he reads that week, obviously. He reads constantly. So do a lot of people, and they have to be satisfied. Mm. But on the very far edges of the audience are the people that read one book a year on their vacation, on the beach. That's all they will read. And you've got to satisfy both those readers and everybody in between.
And you feel them out there. You feel that immense audience.
Yeah, because you meet them. You know, you meet the extremely unlikely people that are fans. And then you meet people who are clearly the one book a year person. And touchingly, their biggest compliment that they can pay you is they will say, I loved your book. I finished it. Which
wow.
is a huge achievement. They feel that it's their achievement.
It's an unusual act.
Yeah, they finished a book. They're very satisfied. They're happy with themselves. And, of course, they're happy with the book because the book has aided them to do that. And how do you do that? The real skill, and I think the skill that Andy Martin observed day to day, is the rhythms of the book. The book has got to be a locomotive that drives people through without being noticeably such.
Finally, we'll Jack Reacher ever leave us or leave you?
I'm fascinated with the whole showbiz thing of leave them wanting more. Don't be the embarrassing guy that sticks around two seasons too long. We see that all the time in, you know, shows on television. We see it with athletes. You've got to pick your time to go. And I do not want Reacher to become an embarrassing old character that's bought kind of out of habit or sentimentality.
So you might leave him behind and write about someone or something else?
No, I would leave him behind and retire completely. Do not forget, I'm from Europe. I have no work ethic. Retirement is a phase of life that I'm keenly looking forward to.
Are you?
Yeah.
Would you do on September 1st?
Read. That's the only thing I resent about writing is the time it takes away from reading. That I would... literally, I've got rooms full of books just stacking up, just waiting to be read.
What's the biggest masterpiece that's just sitting there staring at you and saying, you have not read me?
I've never read Jane Austen, which is shocking for an English person. But the Russians of the 19th century, maybe Flaubert, stuff like that. And then, of course, the fabulous thing about books is you don't know what the classics are. There's something sitting there in my living room right now that is could be the best read of my life. And I don't know what it is yet because I haven't tried it.
Well, Lee Child, I'm incredibly grateful to you, but don't leave Jack Reacher too soon, okay?
I honestly...
You can squeeze in Jane Austen somehow.
I could probably read her in the evenings after I finished writing Reacher, but that would be quite a contrast.
Lee Child, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I spoke with Lee Child in 2018. The most recent Jack Reacher novel is called Better Off Dead, and it was co-written with his brother, Andrew Child. The 8-episode series Reacher premiered on Amazon on Friday. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, we're in a moment when issues of speech are leading headlines week after week. Battles over what people can or should be able to say on Spotify podcasts, Netflix specials, on social media, and in school classrooms around the country. Next week on the program, we're going to look at many sides of that complex issue. And one of the people I talk to is Cliff Nesteroff, who studies the history of comedy. Nesteroff argues that debates about representation, particularly of minority groups, are not new at all in our society.
It's interesting if you look at the 1930s, of course, blackface was still prevalent and black stereotypes were prevalent. If you read the black press, which you can now do thanks to the internet, go back through the archives of newspaper.com and read the New York Age or the Pittsburgh Courier or the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American or the California Eagle, the major black newspapers of the 1930s, you will see editorials and letters complaining about that shit all the time. Why are we being insulted? Why don't they stop with this hackneyed, tired, old stereotypes? We're beyond this. We're human beings. And nobody listened. So minorities and their concerns were very easily ignored in those days. I just came out with a new book recently, which is about indigenous representation or lack thereof. And I have an example in the book of a contingent of Native American leaders complaining about racist stereotypes in silent movies. The year 1911. Oh, you can't joke about anything anymore. In the year 1911. So that has gone on. Those grievances have been lodged for ages, but were willfully ignored as long as indigenous peoples or African Americans did not have the purchasing power or the influence in the body politic to have their voices heard.
More from Cliff Nesteroff and others on the struggle over speech next week. Now, to close the show this week, I wanted to check in with Graciela Machkovsky. Graciela writes for The New Yorker about politics and culture in Latino communities especially, and she directs a program in bilingual journalism at the City University of New York. Graciela has lived here for years, and she immigrated to the U.S. from Argentina in 2013. She told me that just recently, she started to reconnect to the music that she'd grown up with during the pandemic, when she was spending a lot more time with her family.
So, you know, it's me, my husband, and my son. He's now 10. So the first year of the pandemic in September, we heard that he was going to go back to school to in-person classes every other day. So we decided to get a car, a little Honda Fit, because we would go to the school. That was a 30-minute drive. So this actually led to the need for music and playlists.
Now, Graciela, you grew up in Argentina. Is music something that brings back home in some way? Is there a nostalgic element to you?
I'm not nostalgic. I never really miss home. I miss my parents. I miss people, but I don't miss the country. I was actually so sick of the country when we left. I just really, it was so frustrating. And so what happened when we started, my husband created the playlist, is that, you know, he had a different relationship with the country. He grew up in exile. They were kicked out of the country during our last military dictatorship. So to him, going back to Argentina was always important. I grew up in a very small town in Patagonia and in the provinces, and I always wanted to escape. So one day we're driving and my husband plays this music by this great Argentine singer, Luis Alberto Spinetta. He was a huge figure, a legend in the history of Argentinian rock. We have a National Musicians Day, and it's this guy's birthday. I hated his music. I couldn't stand his voice. He has this very mellow voice, very lyrical. And when I was growing up, I didn't connect with his music. And so we're driving and my husband plays a song by Spinetta. And I'm like, oh, great. You know, the playlist thing created some tension in the cars.
As it always does. As it always does. Yeah. Now, what's the name of the song, Graciela?
So the name of the song is Cantata de Puentes Amarillos.
And how would you translate that?
A song of yellow bridges. It's a 9-minute, 12-second song. I think it's the longest song in Argentinian rock. And it was recorded in 1973. It's a song that connects very different surreal images that come from very different sources. So the song has this moment, which is where I actually converted to Alberto Spinetta on that ride. We stop at a red light and I hear him sing this wonderful line that I'll translate as, even if they force me, I will never say that the past was better, tomorrow is better. Aunque me fuercen, yo nunca voy a decir que todo el tiempo por pasado fue mejor. Mañana es mejor. And then at the end, he just sings tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. And this is September 2020. There was no vaccine yet. A song that really spoke to this moment, which was really unexpected because he didn't mean that. But, you know, that's what music does.
What would be your second pick on the playlist?
So as I mentioned, you know, I'm from the provinces. And in the provinces, there's this folk music. It's called samba, and it's samba with a Z. So it's not the Brazilian samba. And samba is this... it's a dancing music where a couple dances with white handkerchiefs and they round each other. I hated this music because it was the music of, it was the music of the provinces and this oppression. And being a woman growing up in the provinces, to me, it was really difficult. So that music represented my desire to just leave and never listen to that music again. And one of our major folk singers, she passed in 2009. Mercedes Sosa is her name. And she was this huge, huge singer. And she was world known. And, you know, she sang in Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. She has a very characteristic voice, very deep, wonderful voice, with a very thick accent from the north of the country. I just couldn't hear that. It made me cringe. And so we... But my husband loves her. Everybody loves her except for me. So we're going to the Catskills one weekend and he plays Mercedes Sosa. I'm like, great, fantastic. And then I start listening to this song. It's called Samba para Olvidarte, which means samba, you know, this music to forget you. No sé para qué volviste. And it's about the end of a love, to forget the person she's loved. But it's very sad, and her voice is so deep, and she's like, there's nothing left of our love, and there's only this song, there's this song in my guitar. And then, like, for the first time, I'm moved by her voice. And I just listen to this song now all the time, and it's become one of my favorite songs. I think it's just beautiful. Tarde se ha puesto triste y yo prefiero callar. ¿Para qué vamos a hablar de cosas que ya no existen? No sé. And finally, we're now getting pretty far south on the FDR Drive, close to your kid's school. And I have to remember my own kids when they were really young and I was foisting music on them. You know, it was a complicated battle. Sometimes they liked it. Little kids always seem to like the Beatles. And then the next thing you foist on them, that's the end and they want their own stuff. What is the final song you're putting in front of your son in the car? And I wonder how he's reacting too. So he doesn't like any of this music, but this third song he really likes. So this is the one we play the most. Those are too sad for him, you know?
Yeah.
So the last one, it's called Loco, Tu Forma de Ser. Loco means crazy, and Tu Forma de Ser means your way of being or the way you are. This is a song from the 90s, and it's a song by Los Auténticos Decadentes, the Authentic Decadents, I guess you'll translate their name. And it's this big band of guys who do ska and reggae and combined with Latin American rhythms like cumbia, candombe, and rock.
What are they singing about, Graciela?
So the wonderful thing about this song is I cannot translate it to you, really, because it's in the vernacular, like a very kind of lowbrow Buenos Aires vernacular. So the first scene is this woman comes into the bar and she's with another guy and she trips and falls for some reason. That's never explained. But then she throws, if you translate it literally, she throws a penguin at him. And a pinguino, a penguin, is actually something only an Argentinian of my generation or older will know. But the penguin is a jar, a ceramic jar in the shape of a penguin that was very traditional to serve cheap Argentinian wine before we invented Argentinian Malbec. So it was like the cheap wine you buy in a gallon plastic. Here would be this jug wine.
Or wine in a box we now have.
Exactly, in a box. And you mixed it with seltzer because it was so bad. That's how my parents still drink wine. So I just feel this sense of exhilaration when I hear these words. And the song is full of these words that are very specific to a moment of Argentinian vernacular. And I do speak Spanish a lot in the city, but I speak Spanish now with Peruvians and Mexicans and Colombians and Caribbeans. You know, I speak Spanglish at home with my kid, but I don't speak Argentinian anymore. So that's what this song is to me. So it's just this joy of reconnecting with my language.
Let's hear it. Let's hear the Authentic Decadents playing Loco. Graciela, obviously for me, these three songs are new, and it's a great pleasure to hear your memories of them. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find Graciela Muchkowski's work for us at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Hope you enjoyed the show and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.